Thank you, Christoph. It's a privilege to speak after Cynthia Klestenek, a scholar from whom I've learned so much and someone whom I'm happy to be able to call a friend. I want to thank both the organizers for including me in the program today and two other friends, Maria Pia Donato and Monique Cornell, who provided encouragement as I thought through some of my ideas for this talk. I also wish to acknowledge the inspiration of Alan Gabby for sharing his views about Shakespeare's Hamlet with me, which will become relevant, you'll see in a moment. All the errors, oversights, and I guarantee you coming mispronunciations are mine alone. In the late 19th century and early decades of the 20th century, an important source for the study of anatomical illustration, and one that I still think bears attending to even today, was Ludwig Coulon's History and Biography of Anatomic Illustration in its relation to anatomy. Originally published in German and subsequently translated into other languages, including into an amended English edition in 1920, Coulon divided the history of anatomical illustration into six distinct periods. The first prior to Berengarius da Carpi, the second from Berengarius to Vesalius, the third from Vesalius to Caesarius, the fourth from Caesarius to Albinus, the fifth from Albinus to Summering, and then the sixth through to modern times. For all the evidence he cites differentiating these six periods, there is a persistent trope spanning from at least the first to the fourth, specifically that art imitates the processes and products of nature, and that this imitation allows for or implicitly justifies an analogy between nature and art when direct knowledge of one or the other is impossible. I will explore this issue through the sources and topics listed here on the slide. You'll note that the bridge connecting nature and art through analogical argument is sometimes conveyed by the thought that the human body, produced by nature, is like a building or machine, or that the human or animal body is a machine, or that to call someone a machine is to refer to their body. Part of what I wish to suggest today is that this last claim, that the human body is a machine, does not always mean that the human body is or is constituted by a collection of mechanisms. So let's begin with Albinus, who marks an inflection point according to Coulon. In his expansive account of the methods adopted in making the tables of the skeleton and muscles, there you go. And so this is a magnificent work for those who have not seen it. It's effectively an elephant folio about this large and this wide, which begins with images of the skeleton and then similarly postured the muscles and other organs are added to it. So in the historical explanation for the work, Albinus tells us that just as architects, having laid a sure foundation, raise the building upon it with all its parts, so we may, on the skeleton as a foundation, annex the muscles, apply the bowel and other parts, and afterwards conduct the nerves, arteries, and veins among them, and superadd whatever more belongs to the fabric of our bodies. And therefore, we will best imitate by art this method pointed out by nature. And this first enabled me to discover that a plan, like plan, was pursued by Eustachius in his tables. It's interesting that Eustachius is cited as a predecessor in the method, another indication that the periods offered by Coulon are porous ones. But it's the analogy between the skeleton to a building that I want to emphasize, because it does real work for Albinus. It not only ends up determining the order of the illustrations as they appear in the text, and of course in Vesalius the bones come first too, but in Albinus's case it sets forth the methods of the anatomist when combining what is learned from the different specimens used to create the illustrations. You first fix the skeleton of one of your anatomical subjects, and then you add on the others as you only go so deep in your dissections. Albinus is able to achieve the high level of precision that Coulon finds in his work precisely because he adopted these methods. Now, the comparison of human art, like the making of an anatomical textbook in Albinus's case, to divinely created nature, on the assumption that their products both come into being through similarly ordered teleological operations, has a long history and is validated by Plato through the mouthpiece of Socrates, by Aristotle and Galen, though all of them do it in slightly different ways. In Aristotle's Physics, for example, he argues that the arts complete the work of nature. In Physics 2.8, he explains, thus, if a house, for example, had been a thing made by nature, it would have been made in the same way as it is now made by art. And if things made by nature were not made only by nature, but also by art, they would come to be in the same way as in nature. Art, in some cases, completes what nature cannot bring to a finish, and in others, imitates nature. Sticking with the analogy of a building to the living body, there's a curious version of this trope in Leonardo da Vinci, who, as you know, looked at buildings as analyzable into their component parts. One of my favorite phrases comes here too. Da Vinci does not, however, draw an analogy between the human body and buildings, as we found in Albinus, but an analogy between the knowledge necessary to understand the two products that the physician or the architect studies and understands. He says, just as doctors should understand what man is, what life is, what health is, and with good knowledge of the things mentioned above, he will be better able to repair than one without it. The same is necessary for a building. That is, and this is the phrase I so much like and seems so appropriate for our gathering over the next few days, that is a doctor architect who has a good knowledge of what a building is and from which rules good building derives and the origins of those rules and into how many parts they are divided and what are the causes that keep a building together and make it last. One area of anatomical investigation in which the analogy between art and nature and the suggestion that one can be used to offer insight into the other has been especially important is in the study of the development and creation of living things, something that Cindy mentioned in passing in one of the anatomical theater moments she was discussing. Here, the analogy, though, it's used in the discussion of development and creation of living things, the analogy is sometimes used to criticize the anatomical views and conclusions of others, especially when they reverse the preferred direction of imitation of art to nature, as they can get conjecture about natural processes or order of production. Take the case, a famous one, of William Harvey, who criticizes his teacher Fabricius, who again Cindy mentioned, when the latter compared the developing embryo to the process of building a ship, an analogy that originated, so far as I've been able to tell, in Galen of Pergamum in the second century, but it's one also embraced by Malpighi, who privileges the carina, or keel, of the embryo, that is, the spine being formed early in embryological development. According to Harvey, however, Fabricius had claimed the first component of the embryo to form like Malpighi later, had to be the spine and bones. But he does it, that is, Fabricius does it, by citing the analogy between shipbuilding and the building of the embryo, where he infers that just as the shipbuilder builds their ship from the keel up or out, so too nature builds the embryo from its skeletal foundation. Harvey notes that Fabricius was not contemplating, quote, what is done by nature in the order of generation, but rather, to his mind, ought to happen according to nature by a resemblance, an analogy to an artificial building, as if, in fact, nature would imitate art and not rather art nature. Harvey is thinking of Aristotle here, for whom art imitates the work of nature, but its mode of production is completely different. Thus, the productions of art cannot teach us anything about how nature operates. Even more pointedly, though, Harvey objected to what he called Fabricius's petty reasonings borrowed from mechanics, which isn't included on the slide, but it's a direct quote. Now, mechanics, of course, were laborers toiling with machines, and they enjoyed a lower social status than university professors like Fabricius. Thus, a further element of Harvey's criticism is that the famous anatomist, his teacher, was engaging in or relying on activities far beneath his station. The analogy between living things and machines is a common one by the 17th century. And though Domenico Bertoloni Melli has told us about the history of mechanism in a recent book, it's the relationship between mechanisms, the parts that we study as anatomists, and machines that I want to explore further, or rather, the ways in which the two might not be related. But to do this, I want to spend my remaining time with you this morning by pushing beyond the disciplinary boundaries historians typically respect, or at least ones that I have often respected myself. For I've come to believe, as I think the organizers of the conference mentioned earlier, that the ways in which we organize knowledge today and the sorts of evidence we consider simply cannot do justice to vital aspects of intellectual, social, and cultural history. So I want to look to literature, to drama specifically, and to the work of Shakespeare, and to that other theater, that other performative space in the early modern period for a moment. Now, as I pivot to literature, it should be noted that the secondary literature on the history of the term machine, which is part of an etymological web that includes mechanical, machination, and mechanic, in addition to mechanism, is vast. For my purposes, by machine, I want to propose we consider a definition from a Cartesian physician from the 1660s. What is a machine? It's a body composed of several organic parts, which being united work together to produce several movements of which they would not be capable if they were separated. I call organic parts all sorts of simple or complex bodies, which being united together are able to help through their structure, shape, movement, rest, and location in the production of the motions and functions of the machine of which they are parts. The emphasis here is on the assemblage of interconnected components designed for a particular purpose or range of purposes to produce desired results. A clock is the example we often find cite in both the primary and secondary literature. So in the period in which we're interested, there were not just machines made to perform all kinds of useful work, though, like a clock, but also theoretical constructions that could never have been made or made to work. There were the five simple machines used to multiply forces, several of which Vitruvius mentions. There were military machines, hydraulic pumps, theatrical machines to produce stage effects, machines for conveyance on road or sea. Through a significant shift in meaning, there emerged the overarching conception of the fabric of the universe as mechanica mundi. The term mechanica also took on the figurative sense of a plot or stratagem, meaning a machination. Now, the Oxford English Dictionary attributes the first appearance of the term machine in English to Shakespeare, and specifically to the play Hamlet, a play Stephen Greenblatt credits with the creation of the inner self, in English at least. The reference here to machine appears in a letter written by the despondent young Prince Hamlet about his unrequited love for Ophelia. And this will all come back to Italian in a moment, I promise you, even though I'm talking about an English play. So the letter in question is read by Paulinus in Act Two of to Hamlet's mother, Gertrude, and the king, his father's murderer. "Good madame, stay a while, I will be faithful. Doubt that the stars are fire, doubt that the sun doth move, doubt truth to be a liar, but never doubt I love. O dear Ophelia, I am ill at these numbers. I have not art to reckon my groans. But that I love thee best, O most best, believe it, adieu. Thine evermore, most dear lady, whilst this machine is to him, Hamlet." Paulinus believes the letter reveals Hamlet's love for Ophelia, a love having been rebuffed, likely caused Hamlet's madness. Looking more closely at the letter, however, Hamlet lays forth three sophisticated doubts on learned subjects: the nature of the stars, which had been debated even before Aristotle claimed the stars are composed of a fifth element and not fire; the sun's motion, which Copernicus called into question, as we all know, in 1543, and whether truth might be a liar, which is likely tied to the 16th century revival of ancient skepticism and possibly the liar paradox from Cicero. It's clearly a learned letter. This same learned letter contains Shakespeare's only use of the term machine. And experts have, naturally enough, I think, taken machine to refer to Hamlet's body. Nowhere, however, and you'll notice that this is the footnote associated with the passage, machine, that is body, and then there's a reference to Bright's Melancholy. Nowhere, however, does Bright say that the human body is a machine, a term he does not even use, as you would probably expect, given that Shakespeare appears to be the first to use it in English. Now, returning to the play itself, no one in the play takes note of the word either, machine. Paulinus says nothing about it, neither do the queen and king, letting machine pass without comment might suggest that they have not come across the term in such a setting, but regardless, they let it pass, perhaps putting it down to Hamlet's madness. It seems to me that the term machine might already simply be a part of the language, a kind of figurative or metaphorical usage current at some level within a particular social setting. Or it could be that Paulinus and the royal couple are assuming that machine must simply stand for Hamlet's body in some sense. Or it might be that they're aware that in theatrical circles, it can mean a piece of stage machinery. You might still want to insist, though, in some ways, that Hamlet is referring to his body. He's declaring he will love Ophelia so long as he is alive, so long as his soul and body are joined in this life. And this is just an expression of romantic excess at the end of the letter. So long as his body exists, this machine, he will love her. Nevertheless, the simple identification of machine with body is too simple. for the use of machine is unique in Shakespeare's work, and I expect there must be more to say. To see this, consider a work Shakespeare almost certainly knew because he knew of Florio's translation of Montaigne. So John Florio's A World of Words. This is an image of the 1611 second edition titled Queen Anne's A New World of Words. And though similar, the 1598 first edition is more directly relevant to the writing of Hamlet. And I want to cite it instead. So this is an Italian-English dictionary, right? I'm not going to read all these out, but I want to cite it because I want to point out something that is missing. You'll notice that Machina, as a body, human or animal, isn't in Florio, though Machina as a scaffold in building or as a building comes close to being a metaphor for the skeleton supporting the human body in which it is clothed. And with this, we've come full circle, back to Albinus and the comparison of a building's foundation to a skeleton, only that now the edifice built upon this machine, Hamlet, is the persistence of his love so long as he remains alive. The point being that the machine in question is more a foundation than a complex mechanism divided into parts coordinated to produce a specific series of effects and outcomes. It's a kind of body object, to use a phrase from the introductory remarks earlier. Okay, so my time is up, but I will conclude with a confession. I'm not altogether confident about precisely what Hamlet might mean by calling himself a machine beyond what I have just offered. Hamlet as this machine may suggest his own body. It may suggest he is socially inferior to his family and Ophelia, that he does not initiate his own behavior, but is forced to do what he does by others, or even that he is an imitator. I am nevertheless confident that his use of machine does not mean or imply some kind of anticipation of later 17th century notions of machine, finding expressions in the likes of Cartesians like Laforge, who I cited earlier, or physicians like Malpighi. To put the lesson of my paper into simple terms, we ought to be circumspect when we find the art-nature analogy being cited and whenever we see references to the body machine in our anatomies. Thank you.